brave, clever, and energetic man, and such men are not usually content to sit at home in hiding while they believe others to be in danger. Nevertheless, you should never have believed for an instant that there was any necessity for you to go to the Department of Mysteries tonight. If I had been open with you, Harry, as I should have been, you would have known a long time ago that Voldemort might try and lure you to the Department of Mysteries, and you would never have been tricked into going there tonight. And Sirius would not have had to come after you. That blame lies with me, and with me alone. Harry was still standing with his hand on the doorknob, but he was unaware of it. He was gazing at Dumbledore, hardly breathing, listening yet barely understanding what he was hearing. "Please sit down," said Dumbledore. It was not an order, it was a request. Harry hesitated, then walked slowly across the room, now littered with silver cogs and fragments of wood, and took the seat facing Dumbledore's desk.
"Am I to understand," said Phineas Nigellus, slowly from Harry's left, "that my great-great-grandson, the last of the Blacks, is dead?"
"Yes, Phineas," said Dumbledore.
"I don't believe it," said Phineas brusquely.
Harry turned his head in time to see Phineas marching out of his portrait and knew that he had gone to visit his other painting in Grimald Place. He would walk, perhaps, from portrait to portrait, calling for Sirius through the house.
"Harry, I owe you an explanation," said Dumbledore. "An explanation of an old man's mistakes. For I see now that what I have done and not done with regard to you bears all the hallmarks of the failings of age. Youth cannot know how age thinks and feels, but old men are guilty if they forget what it was to be young. And I seem to have forgotten lately."
The sun was rising properly now. There was a rim of dazzling orange visible over the mountains, and the sky above it was colourless and bright. The light fell upon Dumbledore, upon the silver of his eyebrows and beard, upon the lines gouged deeply into his face.
"I guessed 15 years ago," said Dumbledore, "when I saw the scar upon your forehead, what it might mean. I guessed that it might be the sign of a connection forged between you and Voldemort."
"You've told me this before, Professor," said Harry bluntly. He did not care about being rude. He did not care about anything very much any more.
"Yes," said Dumbledore apologetically. "Yes, but you see, it is necessary to start with your scar, for it became apparent shortly after you rejoined the magical world that I was correct, and that your scar was giving you warnings when Voldemort was close to you, or else feeling powerful emotion."
"I know," said Harry wearily.
"And this ability of yours to detect Voldemort's presence, even when he is disguised, and to know what he is feeling when his emotions are aroused, has become more and more pronounced since Voldemort returned to his own body and his full powers."
Harry did not bother to nod. He knew all of this already.
"More recently," said Dumbledore, "I became concerned that Voldemort might realize that this connection between you exists. Sure enough, there came a time when you entered so far into his mind and thoughts that he sensed your presence. I am speaking, of course, of the night when you witnessed the attack on Mr. Weasley."
"Yeah, Snape told me," Harry muttered.
"Professor Snape, Harry," Dumbledore corrected him quietly. "But did you not wonder why it was not I who explained this to you? Why I did not teach you occlumency? Why I had not so much as looked at you for months?"
Harry looked up. He could see now that Dumbledore looked sad and tired.
"Yeah," Harry mumbled. "Yeah, I wondered." "You see," continued Dumbledore heavily, "I believed it could not be long before Voldemort attempted to force his way into your mind, to manipulate and misdirect your thoughts, and I was not eager to give him more incentives to do so. I was sure that if he realized that our relationship was, or had ever been, closer than that of headmaster and pupil, he would seize his chance to use you as a means to spy on me. I feared the uses to which he would put you, the possibility that he might try and possess you. Harry, I believe I was right to think that Voldemort would have made use of you in such a way. On those rare occasions when we had close contact, I thought I saw a shadow of him stir behind your eyes. I was trying in distancing myself from you to protect you. An old man's mistake.
Harry remembered the feeling that a dormant snake had risen in him, ready to strike on the occasions when he and Dumbledore made eye contact.
Voldemort's aim in possessing you, as he demonstrated tonight, would not have been my destruction. It would have been yours. He hoped, when he possessed you briefly a short while ago, that I would sacrifice you in the hope of killing him.
He sighed deeply. Harry was letting the words wash over him. He would have been so interested to know all this a few months ago, and now it was meaningless compared to the gaping chasm inside him that was the loss of Sirius. None of it mattered.
Sirius told me that you felt Voldemort awake inside you the very night that you had the vision of Arthur Weasley's attack. I knew at once that my worst fears were correct. Voldemort, from that point, had realized he could use you. In an attempt to arm you against Voldemort's assaults on your mind, I arranged occlumency lessons with Professor Snape.
He paused. Harry watched the sunlight, which was sliding slowly across the polished surface of Dumbledore's desk, illuminate a silver inkpot and a handsome scarlet quill. Harry could tell that the portraits all around them were awake and listening raptly to Dumbledore's explanation. He could hear the occasional rustle of robes, the slight clearing of a throat. Phineas Nigellus had still not returned.
"Professor Snape discovered," Dumbledore resumed, "that you had been dreaming about the door to the Department of Mysteries for months. Voldemort, of course, had been obsessed with the possibility of hearing the prophecy ever since he regained his body. And as he dwelled on the door, so did you, though you did not know what it meant. And then you saw Rookwood, who worked in the Department of Mysteries before his arrest, telling Voldemort what we had known all along, that the prophecies held in the Ministry of Magic are heavily protected. Only the people to whom they refer can lift them from the shelves without suffering madness. In this case, either Voldemort himself would have to enter the Ministry of Magic and risk revealing himself at last, or else you would have to take it for him. It became a matter of even greater urgency that you should master occlumency."
"But I didn't," muttered Harry. He said it aloud to try and ease the dead weight of guilt inside him. A confession must surely relieve some of the terrible pressure squeezing his heart.
"I didn't practice. I didn't bother.
I could have stopped myself having those dreams. Hermione kept telling me to do it. If I had, he'd never have been able to show me where to go, and Sirius wouldn't. Something was erupting inside Harry's head. A need to justify himself, to explain.
"I tried to check he'd really taken Sirius. I went to Umbridge's office. I spoke to Creature in the fire, and he said Sirius wasn't there. He said he'd gone."
"Creature lied," said Dumbledore calmly.
"You are not his master. He could lie to you without even needing to punish himself. Creature intended you to go to the Ministry of Magic."
He sent me on purpose?"
"Oh, yes. Creature, I'm afraid, has been serving more than one master for months."
"How?" said Harry blankly. "He hasn't been out of Grimmauld Place for years."
"Creature seized his opportunity shortly before Christmas," said Dumbledore, "when Sirius apparently shouted at him to get out. He took Sirius at his word and interpreted this as an order to leave the house. He went to the only black family member for whom he had any respect left, Black's cousin Narcissa, sister of Bellatrix and wife of Lucius Malfoy."
"How do you know all this?" Harry said. His heart was beating very fast. He felt sick. He remembered worrying about Creature's odd absence over Christmas, remembered him turning up again in the attic.
"Creature told me last night," said Dumbledore. "You see, when you gave Professor Snape that cryptic warning, he realized that you had had a vision of Sirius trapped in the bowels of the Department of Mysteries. He, like you, attempted to contact Sirius at once. I should explain that members of the Order of the Phoenix have more reliable methods of communicating than the fire in Dolores Umbridge's office. Professor Snape found that Sirius was alive and safe in Grimmauld Place. When, however, you did not return from your trip into the forest with Dolores Umbridge, Professor Snape grew worried that you still believe Sirius to be a captive of Lord Voldemort's,
He alerted certain Order members at once.
Dumbledore heaved a great sigh and then said,
Alistair Moody, Nymphadora Tonks, Kingsley Shacklebolt, and Remus Lupin were at headquarters when he made contact. All agreed to go to your aid at once. Professor Snape requested that Sirius remain behind, as he needed somebody to remain at headquarters to tell me what had happened, for I was due there at any moment. In the meantime, he, Professor Snape, intended to search the forest for you. But Sirius did not wish to remain behind while the others went to search for you. He delegated to Creature the task of telling me what had happened. And so it was that when I arrived in Grimald Place shortly after they had all left for the Ministry, it was the elf who told me, laughing fit to burst, where Sirius had gone.
He was laughing? Said Harry in a hollow voice.
Oh, yes, said Dumbledore. You see, Creature was not able to betray us totally. He is not secret keeper for the Order. He could not give the Malfoys our whereabouts or tell them any of the Order's confidential plans that he had been forbidden to reveal. He was bound by the enchantments of his kind, which is to say that he could not disobey a direct order from his master Sirius. But he gave Narcissa information of the sort that is very valuable to Voldemort, yet must have seemed much too trivial for Sirius to think of banning him from repeating it.
Like what? Said Harry.
Like the fact that the person Sirius cared most about in the world was you, said Dumbledore quietly. Like the fact that you were coming to regard Sirius as a mixture of father and brother. Voldemort knew already, of course, that Sirius was in the Order, that you knew where he was, but Creature's information made him realize that the one person whom you would go to any lengths to rescue was Sirius Black.
Harry's lips were cold and numb.
So when I asked Creature if Sirius was there last night, the Malfoys, undoubtedly on Voldemort's instructions, had told him he must find a way of keeping Sirius out of the way once you had seen the vision of Sirius being tortured. Then, if you decided to check whether Sirius was at home or not, Creature would be able to pretend he was not. Creature injured Buckbeak the Hippogriff yesterday, and at the moment when you made your appearance in the fire, Sirius was upstairs trying to tend to him.
There seemed to be very little air in Harry's lungs. His breathing was quick and shallow.
And Creature told you all this, and laughed, he croaked. He did not wish to tell me, said Dumbledore, but I am a sufficiently accomplished legilimens myself to know when I am being lied to, and I persuaded him to tell me the full story before I left for the Department of Mysteries. And whispered Harry, his hands curled in cold fists on his knees, and Hermione kept telling us to be nice to him. She was quite right, Harry, said Dumbledore. I warned Sirius when we adopted 12 Grimald Place as our headquarters that Creature must be treated with kindness and respect. I also told him that Creature could be dangerous to us. I do not think that Sirius took me very seriously, or that he ever saw Creature as a being with feelings as acute as a human's. Don't you talk about Sirius like...
Harry's breath was constricted. He could not get the words out properly, but the rage that had subsided so briefly had flared in him again. He would not let Dumbledore criticize Sirius.
Creature's a lying foul. He deserved... Creature is what he has been made by wizards, Harry, said Dumbledore. Yes, he is to be pitied. His existence has been as miserable as your friend Dobby's. He was forced to do Sirius's bidding because Sirius was the last of the family to which he was enslaved. But he felt no true loyalty to him, and whatever Creature's faults, it must be admitted that Sirius did nothing to make Creature's lot easier.
Don't talk about Sirius like that, Harry yelled. He was on his feet again, furious, ready to fly at Dumbledore, who had plainly not understood Sirius at all. How brave he was, how much he had suffered.
What about Snape? Harry spat. You're not talking about him, are you? When I told him Voldemort had Sirius, he just sneered at me as usual. Harry, you know that Professor Snape had no choice but to pretend not to take you seriously in front of Dolores Umbridge, said Dumbledore steadily. But as I have explained, he informed the Order as soon as possible about what you had said.
It was he who deduced where you had gone when you did not return from the forest. It was he, too, who gave Professor Umbridge fake Veritas serum when she was attempting to force you to tell of Sirius's whereabouts. Harry disregarded this. He felt a savage pleasure in blaming Snape. It seemed to be easing his own sense of dreadful guilt, and he wanted to hear Dumbledore agree with him. Snape goaded Sirius about staying in the house. He made out Sirius was a coward. "Sirius was much too old and clever to have allowed such feeble taunts to hurt him," said Dumbledore. "Snape stopped giving me occlumency lessons," Harry snarled. "He threw me out of his office."
"I am aware of it," said Dumbledore heavily. "I have already said that it was a mistake for me not to teach you myself, though I was sure at the time that nothing could have been more dangerous than to open your mind even further to Voldemort while in my presence.
Snape made it worse. My scar always hurt worse after lessons with him." Harry remembered Ron's thoughts on the subject and plunged on. "How do you know he wasn't trying to soften me up for Voldemort, make it easier for him to get inside my..."
"I trust Severus Snape," said Dumbledore simply. "But I forgot another old man's mistake, that some wounds run too deep for the healing. I thought Professor Snape could overcome his feelings about your father. I was wrong."
"But that's okay, is it?" yelled Harry, ignoring the scandalized faces and disapproving mutterings of the portraits covering the walls. "It's okay for Snape to hate my dad, but it's not okay for Sirius to hate Creature."
"Sirius did not hate Creature," said Dumbledore. "He regarded him as a servant unworthy of much interest or notice. Indifference and neglect often do much more damage than outright dislike. The fountain we destroyed tonight told a lie. We wizards have mistreated and abused our fellows for too long, and we are now reaping our reward."
"So Sirius deserved what he got, did he?" Harry yelled.
"I did not say that, nor will you ever hear me say it," Dumbledore replied quietly. "Sirius was not a cruel man. He was kind to house elves in general. He had no love for Creature, because Creature was a living reminder of the home Sirius had hated."
"Yeah, he did hate it," said Harry, his voice cracking, turning his back on Dumbledore and walking away. The sun was bright inside the room now, and the eyes of all the portraits followed him as he walked, without realizing what he was doing, without seeing the office at all.
"You made him stay shut up in that house, and he hated it. That's why he wanted to get out last night." "I was trying to keep Sirius alive," said Dumbledore quietly. "People don't like being locked up," Harry said furiously, rounding on him. "You did it to me all last summer."
Dumbledore closed his eyes and buried his face in his long-fingered hands. Harry watched him, but this uncharacteristic sign of exhaustion or sadness or whatever it was from Dumbledore did not soften him. On the contrary, he felt even angrier that Dumbledore was showing signs of weakness. He had no business being weak when Harry wanted to rage and storm at him. Dumbledore lowered his hands and surveyed Harry through his half-moon glasses.
"It is time," he said, "for me to tell you what I should have told you 5 years ago, Harry. Please sit down. I'm going to tell you everything. I ask only a little patience. You will have your chance to rage at me to do whatever you like when I've finished. I will not stop you."
Harry glared at him for a moment, then flung himself back into the chair opposite Dumbledore and waited. Dumbledore stared for a moment at the sunlit grounds outside the window, then looked back at Harry and said,
"5 years ago, you arrived at Hogwarts, Harry, safe and whole as I had planned and intended. Well, not quite whole. You had suffered. I knew you would when I left you on your aunt and uncle's doorstep. I knew I was condemning you to 10 dark and difficult years."
He paused. Harry said nothing.
"You might ask, and with good reason, why it had to be so. Why could some wizarding family not have taken you in? Many would have done so more than gladly, would have been honored and delighted to raise you as a son. My answer is that my priority was to keep you alive. You were in more danger than perhaps anyone but myself realized. Voldemort had been vanquished hours before, but his supporters, and many of them are almost as terrible as he, were still at large, angry, desperate, and violent.
and I had to make my decision, too, with regard to the years ahead. Did I believe that Voldemort was gone forever? No. I knew not whether it would be 10, 20, or 50 years before he returned, but I was sure he would do so. And I was sure, too, knowing him as I have done, that he would not rest until he killed you. I knew that Voldemort's knowledge of magic is perhaps more extensive than any wizard alive. I knew that even my most complex and powerful protective spells and charms were unlikely to be invincible if he ever returned to full power. But I knew, too, where Voldemort was weak. And so I made my decision. You would be protected by an ancient magic of which he knows, which he despises, and which he has always, therefore, underestimated to his cost. I am speaking, of course, of the fact that your mother died to save you. She gave you a lingering protection he never expected, a protection that flows in your veins to this day. I put my trust, therefore, in your mother's blood. I delivered you to her sister, her only remaining relative. She doesn't love me, said Harry at once. She doesn't give a damn. But she took you, Dumbledore cut across him. She may have taken you grudgingly, furiously, unwillingly, bitterly, yet still she took you. And in doing so, she sealed the charm I placed upon you. Your mother's sacrifice made the bond of blood the strongest shield I could give you. I still don't. While you can still call home the place where your mother's blood dwells, there you cannot be touched or harmed by Voldemort. He shed her blood, but it lives on in you and her sister. Her blood became your refuge. You need return there only once a year, but as long as you can still call it home, there he cannot hurt you. Your aunt knows this. I explained what I had done in the letter I left with you on her doorstep. She knows that allowing you house room may well have kept you alive for the past 15 years. Wait, said Harry. Wait a moment. He sat up straighter in his chair, staring at Dumbledore. You sent that howler. You told her to remember. It was your voice. I thought, said Dumbledore, inclining his head slightly, that she might need reminding of the pact she had sealed by taking you. I suspected the Dementor attack might have awoken her to the dangers of having you as a surrogate son. It did, said Harry quietly. Well, my uncle more than her. He wanted to chuck me out, but after the howler came, she said I had to stay. He stared at the floor for a moment, then said, But what's this got to do with... He could not say Sirius's name. 5 years ago, then, continued Dumbledore, as though he had not paused in his story, you arrived at Hogwarts, neither as happy nor as well-nourished as I would have liked, perhaps, yet alive and healthy. You were not a pampered little prince, but as normal a boy as I could have hoped under the circumstances. Thus far my plan was working well. And then, well, you will remember the events of your first year at Hogwarts quite as clearly as I do. You rose magnificently to the challenge that faced you, and sooner, much sooner than I had anticipated, you found yourself face to face with Voldemort. You survived again. You did more. You delayed his return to full power and strength. You fought a man's fight. I was prouder of you than I can say. Yet there was a flaw in this wonderful plan of mine, said Dumbledore. An obvious flaw that I knew even then might be the undoing of it all. And yet, knowing how important it was that my plan should succeed, I told myself that I would not permit this flaw to ruin it. I alone could prevent this, so I alone must be strong. And here was my first test, as you lay in the hospital wing, weak from your struggle with Voldemort. I don't understand what you're saying, said Harry. Don't you remember asking me, as you lay in the hospital wing, why Voldemort had tried to kill you when you were a baby? Harry nodded. Ought I to have told you, then? Harry stared into the blue eyes and said nothing, but his heart was racing again. Do you not see the flaw in the plan yet? No, perhaps not. Well, as you know, I decided not to answer you. 11, I told myself, was much too young to know. I had never intended to tell you when you were 11. The knowledge would be too much at such a young age. I should have recognized the danger signs then. I should have asked myself why I did not feel more disturbed that you had already asked me the question to which I knew one day I must give a terrible answer. I should have recognized that I was too happy to think that I did not have to do it on that particular day. You were too young, much too young. And so we entered your second year at Hogwarts, and once again you met challenges even grown wizards have never faced. Once again you acquitted yourself beyond my wildest dreams. You did not ask me again, however, why Voldemort had left that mark upon you. We discussed your scar, oh yes. We came very, very close to the subject. Why did I not tell you everything? Well, it seemed to me that 12 was, after all, hardly better than 11 to receive such information. I allowed you to leave my presence, bloodstained, exhausted, but exhilarated. And if I felt a twinge of unease that I ought perhaps have told you then, it was swiftly silenced. You were still so young, you see, and I could not find it in me to spoil that night of triumph. Do you see, Harry? Do you see the flaw in my brilliant plan now? I had fallen into the trap I had foreseen, that I had told myself I could avoid, that I must avoid. I cared about you too much, said Dumbledore simply. I cared more for your happiness than your knowing the truth. More for your peace of mind than my plan. More for your life than the lives that might be lost if the plan failed. In other words, I acted exactly as Voldemort expects we fools who love to act. Is there a defense? I defy anyone who has watched you as I have, and I have watched you more closely than you can have imagined, not to want to save you more pain than you had already suffered. What did I care if numbers of nameless and faceless people and creatures were slaughtered in the vague future? If in the here and now you were alive and well and happy, I never dreamed that I would have such a person on my hands. We entered your third year. I watched from afar as you struggled to repel Dementors, as you found Sirius, learned what he was, and rescued him. Was I to tell you then, at the moment when you had triumphantly snatched your godfather from the jaws of the Ministry? But now, at the age of 13, my excuses were running out. Young you might be, but you had proved you were exceptional. My conscience was uneasy, Harry. I knew the time must come soon. But you came out of the maze last year, having watched Cedric Diggory die, having escaped death so narrowly yourself, and I did not tell you, though I knew now Voldemort had returned, I must do it soon. And now tonight, I know you have long been ready for the knowledge I have kept from you for so long, because you have proved that I should have placed the burden upon you before this. My only defense is this. I have watched you struggling under more burdens than any student who has ever passed through this school, and I could not bring myself to add another, the greatest one of all. Harry waited, but Dumbledore did not speak. I still don't understand. Voldemort tried to kill you when you were a child because of a prophecy made shortly before your birth. He knew the prophecy had been made, though he did not know its full contents. He set out to kill you when you were still a baby, believing he was fulfilling the terms of the prophecy. He discovered to his cost that he was mistaken, when the curse intended to kill you backfired. And so, since his return to his body, and particularly since your extraordinary escape from him last year, he has been determined to hear that prophecy in its entirety. This is the weapon he has been seeking so assiduously since his return, the knowledge of how to destroy you. The sun had risen fully now. Dumbledore's office was bathed in it. The glass case in which the sword of Godric Gryffindor resided gleamed white and opaque. The fragments of the instruments Harry had thrown to the floor glistened like raindrops, and behind him the baby forks made soft chirruping noises in his nest of ashes. "The prophecy's smashed," Harry said blankly. "I was pulling Neville up those benches in the room where the archway was, and I ripped his robes, and it fell." The thing that smashed was merely the record of the prophecy kept by the Department of Mysteries. But the prophecy was made to somebody, and that person has the means of recalling it perfectly.
Who heard it?
Asked Harry, though he thought he knew the answer already.
I did,
said Dumbledore, on a cold, wet night 16 years ago, in a room above the bar at the Hogshead Inn. I had gone there to see an applicant for the post of divination teacher, though it was against my inclination to allow the subject of divination to continue at all. The applicant, however, was the great-great-granddaughter of a very famous, very gifted seer, and I thought it common politeness to meet her. I was disappointed. It seemed to me that she had not a trace of the gift herself. I told her, courteously, I hope, that I did not think she would be suitable for the post. I turned to leave.
Dumbledore got to his feet and walked past Harry to the black cabinet that stood beside Fawkes's perch. He bent down, slid back a catch, and took from inside it the shallow stone basin, carved with runes around the edges, in which Harry had seen his father tormenting Snape. Dumbledore walked back to the desk, placed the pensive upon it, and raised his wand to his own temple. From it he withdrew silvery gossamer fine strands of thought clinging to the wand and deposited them in the basin. He sat back down behind his desk and watched his thoughts swirl and drift inside the pensive for a moment. Then, with a sigh, he raised his wand and prodded the silvery substance with its tip. A figure rose out of it, draped in shawls, her eyes magnified to enormous size behind her glasses, and she revolved slowly, her feet in the basin. But when Sybil Trelawney spoke, it was not in her usual ethereal, mystic voice, but in the harsh, hoarse tones Harry had heard her use once before.
The one with the power to vanquish the Dark Lord approaches, born to those who have thrice defied him, born as the seventh month dies, and the Dark Lord will mark him as his equal. But he will have power the Dark Lord knows not, and either must die at the hand of the other, for neither can live while the other survives. The one with the power to vanquish the Dark Lord will be born as the seventh month dies.
The slowly revolving Professor Trelawney sank back into the silver mass below and vanished. The silence within the office was absolute. Neither Dumbledore nor Harry nor any of the portraits made a sound. Even Fawkes had fallen silent.
"Professor Dumbledore,"
Harry said very quietly, for Dumbledore, still staring at the pensive, seemed completely lost in thought.
What did that mean?
It meant, said Dumbledore, that the person who has the only chance of conquering Lord Voldemort for good was born at the end of July, nearly 16 years ago. This boy would be born to parents who had already defied Voldemort 3 times.
Harry felt as though something was closing in upon him. His breathing seemed difficult again.
It means me?
Dumbledore surveyed him for a moment through his glasses.
"The odd thing is, Harry,"
he said softly,
"that it may not have meant you at all. Sybil's prophecy could have applied to 2 wizard boys, both born at the end of July that year, both of whom had parents in the Order of the Phoenix, both sets of parents having narrowly escaped Voldemort 3 times. One, of course, was you. The other was Neville Longbottom."
But then why was it my name on the prophecy and not Neville's?
The official record was relabeled after Voldemort's attack on you as a child, said Dumbledore. It seemed plain to the Keeper of the Hall of Prophecy that Voldemort could only have tried to kill you because he knew you to be the one to whom Sybil was referring.
Then it might not be me, said Harry.
I am afraid,
said Dumbledore slowly, looking as though every word cost him a great effort,
that there is no doubt that it is you.
But you said Neville was born at the end of July too, and his mum and dad...
You are forgetting the next part of the prophecy, the final identifying feature of the boy who could vanquish Voldemort. Voldemort himself would mark him as his equal. And so he did, Harry. He chose you, not Neville. He gave you the scar that has proved both blessing and curse.
But he might have chosen wrong, said Harry. He might have marked the wrong person.
He chose the boy he thought most likely to be a danger to him, said Dumbledore. And notice this, Harry. He chose not the pure blood, which, according to his creed, is the only kind of wizard worth being or knowing, but the half-blood, like himself. He saw himself in you before he had ever seen you, and in marking you with that scar, he did not kill you as he intended, but gave you powers and a future, which have fitted you to escape him not once, but four times so far. Something that neither your parents nor Neville's parents ever achieved.
Why did he do it, then? Said Harry, who felt numb and cold. Why did he try and kill me as a baby? He should have waited to see whether Neville or I looked more dangerous when we were older, and tried to kill whoever it was then.
That might indeed have been the more practical course, said Dumbledore, except that Voldemort's information about the prophecy was incomplete. The Hogshead Inn, which Sybil chose for its cheapness, has long attracted, shall we say, a more interesting clientele than the Three Broomsticks, as you and your friends found out to your cost, and I to mine that night. It is a place where it is never safe to assume you are not being overheard. Of course I had not dreamed when I set out to meet Sybil Trelawney that I would hear anything worth overhearing. My hour, one stroke of good fortune, was that the eavesdropper was detected only a short way into the prophecy and thrown from the building.
So he only heard?
He heard only the first part, the part foretelling the birth of a boy in July to parents who had thrice defied Voldemort. Consequently, he could not warn his master that to attack you would be to risk transferring power to you, again marking you as his equal. So Voldemort never knew that there might be danger in attacking you, that it might be wise to wait or to learn more. He did not know that you would have power the Dark Lord knows not.
But I don't, said Harry in a strangled voice. I haven't any powers he hasn't got. I couldn't fight the way he did tonight. I can't possess people or kill them.
There is a room in the Department of Mysteries, interrupted Dumbledore, that is kept locked at all times. It contains a force that is at once more wonderful and more terrible than death, than human intelligence, than forces of nature. It is also, perhaps, the most mysterious of the many subjects for study that reside there. It is the power held within that room that you possess in such quantities, and which Voldemort has not at all. That power took you to save Sirius tonight. That power also saved you from possession by Voldemort, because he could not bear to reside in a body so full of the force he detests. In the end, it mattered not that you could not close your mind. It was your heart that saved you.
Harry closed his eyes. If he had not gone to save Sirius, Sirius would not have died. More to stave off the moment when he would have to think of Sirius again, Harry asked, without caring much about the answer,
"The end of the prophecy. It was something about... neither can live while the other survives," said Dumbledore.
"So," said Harry, dredging up the words from what felt like a deep well of despair inside him. "So, does that mean that one of us has got to kill the other one in the end?"
"Yes," said Dumbledore.
For a long time, neither of them spoke. Somewhere far beyond the office walls, Harry could hear the sound of voices, students heading down to the great hall for an early breakfast, perhaps. It seemed impossible that there could be people in the world who still desired food, who laughed, who neither knew nor cared that Sirius Black was gone forever. Sirius seemed a million miles away already, even if a part of Harry still believed that if he had only pulled back that veil, he would have found Sirius looking back at him, greeting him, perhaps, with his laugh like a bark.
"I feel I owe you another explanation, Harry," said Dumbledore hesitantly. "You may perhaps have wondered why I never chose you as a prefect. I must confess that I rather thought you had enough responsibility to be going on with."
Harry looked up at him and saw a tear trickling down Dumbledore's face into his long silver beard. Chapter 38 The Second War Begins.
"He who must not be named returns.
In a brief statement Friday night, Minister of Magic Cornelius Fudge confirmed that he who must not be named has returned to this country and is active once more. It is with great regret that I must confirm that the wizard styling himself Lord, well, you know who I mean, is alive and among us again, said Fudge, looking tired and flustered as he addressed reporters. It is with almost equal regret that we report the mass revolt of the Dementors of Azkaban, who have shown themselves averse to continuing in the Minister's employ. We believe that the Dementors are currently taking direction from Lord Thingy. We urge the magical population to remain vigilant. The Ministry is currently publishing guides to elementary home and personal defense that will be delivered free to all wizarding homes within the coming month. The minister's statement was met with dismay and alarm from the wizarding community, which, as recently as last Wednesday, was receiving ministry assurances that there was no truth whatsoever in these persistent rumors that you know who is operating amongst us once more. Details of the events that led to the ministry turnaround are still hazy, though it is believed that he who must not be named and a select band of followers known as Death Eaters gained entry to the Ministry of Magic itself on Friday evening. Albus Dumbledore, newly reinstated headmaster of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, reinstated member of the International Confederation of Wizards, and reinstated chief warlock of the Wizengamot, was unavailable for comment last night. He has insisted for a year that you-know-who was not dead, as was widely hoped and believed, but recruiting followers once more for a fresh attempt to seize power. Meanwhile, the boy who lived... "There you are, Harry. I knew they'd drag you into it somehow," said Hermione, looking over the top of the paper at him. They were in the hospital wing. Harry was sitting on the end of Ron's bed, and they were both listening to Hermione read the front page of the Sunday Prophet. Ginny, whose ankle had been mended in a trice by Madame Pomfrey, was curled up at the foot of Hermione's bed. Neville, whose nose had likewise been returned to its normal size and shape, was in a chair between the two beds. And Luna, who had dropped in to visit, clutching the latest edition of the Quibbler, was reading the magazine upside down and apparently not taking in a word Hermione was saying.
"He's the boy who lived again now, though, isn't he?" said Ron darkly. "Not such a show-off maniac anymore, eh?"
He helped himself to a handful of chocolate frogs from the immense pile on his bedside cabinet, threw a few to Harry, Ginny and Neville, and ripped off the wrapper of his own with his teeth. There were still deep welts on his forearms where the brain's tentacles had wrapped around him. According to Madame Pomfrey, thoughts could leave deeper scarring than almost anything else. Though since she had started applying copious amounts of Dr. Ubley's oblivious unction, there seemed to be some improvement.
"Yes, they're very complimentary about you now, Harry," said Hermione, now scanning down the article. "A lone voice of truth, perceived as unbalanced, yet never wavered in his story, forced to bear ridicule and slander."
Said Hermione, frowning.
"I notice they don't mention the fact that it was them doing all the ridiculing and slandering, though."
She winced slightly and put a hand to her ribs. The curse Dolohov had used on her, though less effective than it would have been had he been able to say the incantation aloud, had nevertheless caused, in Madame Pomfrey's words, quite enough damage to be going on with. Hermione was having to take 10 different types of potion every day, and although she was improving greatly, was already bored with the hospital wing.
"You know who's last attempt to take over, pages 2 to 4. What the Ministry should have told us, page 5. Why nobody listened to Albus Dumbledore, pages 6 to 8. Exclusive interview with Harry Potter, page 9.
"Well," said Hermione, folding up the newspaper and throwing it aside,
"it's certainly given them lots to write about. And that interview with Harry isn't exclusive. It's the one that was in the Quibbler months ago."
"Daddy sold it to them," said Luna vaguely, turning a page of the Quibbler. "He got a very good price for it, too. So we're going to go on an expedition to Sweden this summer and see if we can catch a Crumplehorn Snorkak."
Hermione seemed to struggle with herself for a moment, then said,
"That sounds lovely."
Ginny caught Harry's eye and looked away quickly, grinning.
"So, anyway," said Hermione, sitting up a little straighter and wincing again, "what's going on in school?"
"Well, Flitwick's got rid of Fred and George's swamp," said Ginny.
He did it in about 3 seconds, but he left a tiny patch under the window, and he's roped it off.
Why? Said Hermione, looking startled.
Oh, he just says it was a really good bit of magic, said Ginny, shrugging.
I think he left it as a monument to Fred and George, said Ron through a mouthful of chocolate. They sent me all these, you know, he told Harry, pointing at the small mountain of frogs beside him. Must be doing all right out of that joke shop, eh?
Hermione looked rather disapproving and asked,
So has all the trouble stopped now Dumbledore's back?
Yes, said Neville. Everything's settled right back down again.
I suppose Filch is happy, is he? Asked Ron, propping a chocolate frog card featuring Dumbledore against his water jug.
Not at all, said Ginny. He's really, really miserable, actually. She lowered her voice to a whisper. He keeps saying Umbridge was the best thing that ever happened to Hogwarts.
All six of them looked around. Professor Umbridge was lying in a bed opposite them, gazing up at the ceiling. Dumbledore had strode alone into the forest to rescue her from the centaurs. How he had done it, how he had emerged from the trees, supporting Professor Umbridge without so much as a scratch on him, nobody knew. And Umbridge was certainly not telling. Since she had returned to the castle, she had not, as far as any of them knew, uttered a single word. Nobody really knew what was wrong with her either. Her usual neat, mousy hair was very untidy, and there were bits of twig and leaf in it. But otherwise she seemed to be quite unscathed.
"Madame Pomfrey says she's just in shock," whispered Hermione.
"Sulking, more like," said Ginny.
"Yeah, she shows signs of life if you do this," said Ron,
and with his tongue he made soft clip-clopping noises. Umbridge sat bolt upright, looking wildly around.
"Anything wrong, Professor?" called Madame Pomfrey, poking her head around her office door.
"No, no,"
said Umbridge, sinking back into her pillows.
"No, I must have been dreaming."
Hermione and Ginny muffled their laughter in the bedclothes.
"Speaking of centaurs," said Hermione when she had recovered a little, "who's divination teacher now? Is Ferenczi staying?"
"He's got to," said Harry. "The other centaurs won't take him back, will they?"
"It looks like he and Trelawney are both going to teach," said Ginny.
"Bet Dumbledore wishes he could have got rid of Trelawney for good," said Ron,
now munching on his 14th frog.
"Mind you, the whole subject's useless, if you ask me. Ferenczi isn't a lot better."
"How can you say that?"
Hermione demanded,
"after we've just found out that there are real prophecies."
Harry's heart began to race. He had not told Ron, Hermione, or anyone else what the prophecy had contained. Neville had told them it had smashed while Harry was pulling him up the steps in the Death Room, and Harry had not yet corrected this impression. He was not ready to see their expressions when he told them that he must be either murderer or victim. There was no other way.
"It is a pity it broke," said Hermione quietly, shaking her head.
"Yeah, it is," said Ron.
"Still, at least you know who never found out what was in it either. Where are you going?"
he added, looking both surprised and disappointed as Harry stood up.
"Hagrid's," said Harry. "You know, he's just got back, and I promised I'd go down and see him, tell him how you two are."
"Oh, all right then," said Ron grumpily, looking out of the dormitory window at the patch of bright blue sky beyond.
"Wish we could come."
"Say hello to him for us," called Hermione, as Harry proceeded down the ward. "And ask him what's happening about his little friend."
Harry gave a wave of his hand to show that he had heard and understood as he left the dormitory. The castle seemed very quiet, even for a Sunday. Everybody was clearly out in the sunny grounds, enjoying the end of their exams and the prospect of a last few days of term unhampered by studying or homework. Harry walked slowly along the deserted corridor, peering out of windows as he went. He could see people messing around in the air over the Quidditch pitch and a couple of students swimming in the lake, accompanied by the giant squid. He was finding it hard at the moment to decide whether he wanted to be with people or not. Whenever he was in company, he wanted to get away, and whenever he was alone, he wanted company. He thought he might really go and visit Hagrid, though. He had not talked to him properly since he had returned. Harry had just descended the last marble step into the entrance hall when Malfoy, Crabbe and Goyle emerged from a door on the right that Harry knew led down to the Slytherin common room. Harry stopped dead. So did Malfoy and the others. For a few moments, the only sounds were the shouts, laughter, and splashes drifting into the hall from the grounds through the open front doors. Malfoy glanced around. Harry knew he was checking for signs of teachers. Then he looked back at Harry and said in a low voice,
"You're dead, Potter."
Harry raised his eyebrows. "Funny," he said. "You'd think I'd have stopped walking around." Malfoy looked angrier than Harry had ever seen him. He felt a kind of detached satisfaction at the sight of his pale, pointed face contorted with rage.
"You're going to pay," said Malfoy in a voice barely louder than a whisper. "I'm going to make you pay for what you've done to my father." "Well, I'm terrified now," said Harry sarcastically. "I suppose Lord Voldemort's just a warm-up act compared to you three."
"What's the matter?" he said, for Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle had all looked stricken at the sound of the name. "He's your dad's mate, isn't he? Not scared of him, are you?"
"You think you're such a big man, Potter,"
said Malfoy, advancing now, Crabbe and Goyle flanking him.
"You wait. I'll have you. You can't land my father in prison."
"I thought I just had," said Harry.
"The Dementors have left Azkaban," said Malfoy quietly. "Dad and the others will be out in no time."
"Yeah, I expect they will," said Harry. "Still, at least everyone knows what scumbags they are now." Malfoy's hand flew toward his wand, but Harry was too quick for him. He had drawn his own wand before Malfoy's fingers had even entered the pocket of his robes.
"Potter!"
The voice rang across the entrance hall. Snape had emerged from the staircase leading down to his office. And at the sight of him, Harry felt a great rush of hatred beyond anything he felt toward Malfoy. Whatever Dumbledore said, he would never forgive Snape, never.
"What are you doing, Potter?"
said Snape coldly as ever, as he strode over to the four of them.
"I'm trying to decide what curse to use on Malfoy, sir," said Harry fiercely.
Snape stared at him.
"Put that wand away at once," he said curtly. 10 points from Griff."
Snape looked toward the giant hourglasses on the walls and gave a sneering smile.
"Ah, I see there are no longer any points left in the Gryffindor hourglass to take away. In that case, Potter, we will simply have to add some more."
Professor McGonagall had just stumped up the stone steps into the castle. She was carrying a tartan carpet bag in one hand and leaning heavily on a walking stick with her other, but otherwise looked quite well.
"Professor McGonagall," said Snape, striding forward. "Out of St. Mungo's, I see."
"Yes, Professor Snape," said Professor McGonagall, shrugging off her travelling cloak. "I'm quite as good as new. You too, Crabbe, Goyle."
She beckoned them forward imperiously, and they came, shuffling their large feet and looking awkward.
"Here,"
said Professor McGonagall, thrusting her carpet bag into Crabbe's chest and her cloak into Goyle's.
"Take these up to my office for me."
They turned and stumped away up the marble staircase.
"Right then,"
said Professor McGonagall, looking up at the hourglasses on the wall.
"Well, I think Potter and his friends ought to have 50 points apiece for alerting the world to the return of you-know-who. What say you, Professor Snape?"
"What?"
snapped Snape, though Harry knew he had heard perfectly well.
"Oh, well, I suppose.
So that's 50 each for Potter, the 2 Weasleys, Longbottom and Miss Granger,"
said Professor McGonagall. And a shower of rubies fell down into the bottom bulb of Gryffindor's hourglass as she spoke.
"Oh, and 50 for Miss Lovegood, I suppose," she added, and a number of sapphires fell into Ravenclaw's glass. "Now, you wanted to take 10 from Mr. Potter, I think, Professor Snape. So, there we are."
A few rubies retreated into the upper bulb, leaving a respectable amount below, nevertheless.
"Well, Potter, Malfoy, I think you ought to be outside on a glorious day like this," Professor McGonagall continued briskly.
Harry did not need telling twice. He thrust his wand back inside his robes and headed straight for the front doors without another glance at Snape and Malfoy. The hot sun hit him with a blast as he walked across the lawns toward Hagrid's cabin. Students lying around on the grass, sunbathing, talking, reading the Sunday Prophet, and eating sweets, looked up at him as he passed.
Some called out to him, or else waved, clearly eager to show that they, like the prophet, had decided he was something of a hero. Harry said nothing to any of them. He had no idea how much they knew of what had happened 3 days ago, but he had so far avoided being questioned and preferred it that way. He thought at first, when he knocked on Hagrid's cabin door, that he was out. But then Fang came charging around the corner and almost bowled him over with the enthusiasm of his welcome. Hagrid, it transpired, was picking runner beans in his back garden.
"All right, Harry,"
he said, beaming, when Harry approached the fence.
"Come in, come in. We'll have a cup of dandelion juice." "How's things?"
Hagrid asked him as they settled down at his wooden table with a glass apiece of ice juice.
"You, feeling all right, are you?"
Harry knew from the look of concern on Hagrid's face that he was not referring to Harry's physical well-being. "I'm fine," Harry said quickly, because he could not bear to discuss the thing that he knew was in Hagrid's mind. "So, where have you been?"
"Been hiding out in the mountains," said Hagrid. "Up in a cave, like Sirius did when he..."
Hagrid broke off, cleared his throat gruffly, looked at Harry, and took a long draught of juice.
"Anyway, back now," he said feebly.
You look better," said Harry, who was determined to keep the conversation moving away from Sirius.
"What?"
said Hagrid, raising a massive hand and feeling his face.
Oh, yeah. Well, Grop is loads better behaved now, loads. Seem right pleased to see me when I got back, to tell you the truth. He's a good lad, really. I've been thinking about trying to find him a lady friend, actually."
Harry would normally have tried to persuade Hagrid out of this idea at once. The prospect of a second giant taking up residence in the forest, possibly even wilder and more brutal than Grop, was positively alarming, but somehow Harry could not muster the energy necessary to argue the point. He was starting to wish he was alone again. And with the idea of hastening his departure, he took several large gulps of his dandelion juice, half-emptying his glass.
"Everyone knows you've been telling the truth now, Harry,"
said Hagrid softly and unexpectedly. He was watching Harry closely.
"That's got to be better, hasn't it?"
Harry shrugged.
"Look."
Hagrid leaned toward him across the table.
"I knew Sirius longer than you did. He died in battle, and that's the way he'd have wanted to go."
"He didn't want to go at all," said Harry angrily. Hagrid bowed his great shaggy head.
"Nah, I don't reckon he did," he said quietly. "But still, Harry, he was never one to sit around at home and let other people do the fighting. He couldn't have lived with himself if he hadn't gone to help."
Harry leapt up again. "I've got to go and visit Ron and Hermione in the hospital wing," he said mechanically.
"Oh,"
said Hagrid, looking rather upset.
"Oh, all right then, Harry. Take care of yourself then, and drop back in if you've got a mo."
"Yeah, right." Harry crossed to the door as fast as he could and pulled it open. He was out in the sunshine again before Hagrid had finished saying goodbye and walked away across the lawn. Once again, people called out to him as he passed. He closed his eyes for a few moments, wishing they would all vanish, that he could open his eyes and find himself alone in the grounds. A few days ago, before his exams had finished and he had seen the vision Voldemort had planted in his mind, he would have given almost anything for the wizarding world to know that he had been telling the truth, for them to believe that Voldemort was back and know that he was neither a liar nor mad. Now, however... He walked a short way around the lake, sat down on its bank, sheltered from the gaze of passers-by behind a tangle of shrubs, and stared out over the gleaming water, thinking. Perhaps the reason he wanted to be alone was because he had felt isolated from everybody since his talk with Dumbledore. An invisible barrier separated him from the rest of the world. He was, he had always been, a marked man. It was just that he had never really understood what that meant. And yet, sitting here on the edge of the lake with the terrible weight of grief dragging at him, with the loss of Sirius so raw and fresh inside, he could not muster any great sense of fear.
It was sunny and the grounds around him were full of laughing people, and even though he felt as distant from them as though he belonged to a different race, it was still very hard to believe as he sat here that his life must include, or end in, murder. He sat there for a long time, gazing out at the water, trying not to think about his godfather, or to remember that it was directly across from here, on the opposite bank, that Sirius had collapsed, trying to fend off